Thank you very much, and good morning. I always like being the last, like dessert. But thank you very much for sticking around. I know that it's sometimes it's difficult getting in and out of San Diego. But then I hear that you most are from the Midwest and New England and other representative states that you're probably not so anxious to get home right now. Hopefully none of your flights have been canceled since all the snow has stopped. You know, so be it. I've been stuck in worse places than San Diego in my days. So I was asked to come and speak, and I'm not going to bore you with slides. I thought, you know, maybe what I'd do is give you a pitch on where we are and flash up my PowerPoint presentation, and you'd all fall asleep and nobody would be listening anyway. So I'm going to talk so that nobody's going to be listening, and you won't think you're missing anything. But I've been asked to kind of address how I got here, and more importantly, what inspired me during the time to get involved in a much more deliberate approach as a Department of Defense representative in the world of sustainability and management of our resources. And I kind of go back to the days when I was younger, and for those of you who are Boy Scouts, there, show of hands. Good, thank you. Any Eagles in the crowd? Thank you. But the truth is that, you know, our motto is be prepared. But our Outback motto is leave no trace. And when we would go into the forests and such, a campsite was someplace where you pitched your tent. But when you left in the morning, there was no trace of your having disturbed the environment. And as I grew up as an adult, involved in an organization in which, for all practical purposes, is the single largest consumer of our natural resources, I started to take a look and see just how true to that motto we were as one a nation and two a people. And I started to recognize that, you know what? We're not doing a very good job. As a matter of fact, in my early days, I can remember traveling back and forth. I have made 9 deployments to the Mediterranean, 2 to the Persian Gulf, countless numbers into the North Atlantic. But I can also tell you that I left millions of gallons of fuel in the water as a result of that practice. Because in the early days, when we would go alongside to pump, ships were full when gas poured out of the ullage holes. That's when a ship was topped off. And we did it on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, we fueled every 3 days, every battle group across the globe. So the practice was that if you had things that were aboard ship that you didn't want to bring back into port and you didn't want to have to spend time offloading, 2 days, 3 days before you pulled into port, everything went over the side. Paint, pallets, trash, garbage, plastic, who cares? And eventually the Navy started to take a look at that and say, you know what, this is really wrong. And as I got to be older, I started to understand that as a commanding officer, there was a responsibility for me to instill in my crew my beliefs in what it was all about. When I became the base commanding officer here in San Diego, while I was thrust into the environment of having to be more sustainable because of budget constraints, I really took that as an opportunity to be able to launch the entire organization that I was responsible for into looking at how to be more sustainable in the practice, period. What could we do and how could we do it differently so that we could be more sustainable? And then I started to look at how my previous 26 years at that point, were spent. And I recognized very quickly that one of the areas that we needed to focus our attentions on was our resource that we know as the fossil fuel environment. And recognizing that for the better part of 26 years, most of my time away from home was to do one thing, secure access. And while the bottom line may have been, you know what, we'd like to secure the peace and stability of the region, the national security requirement was to secure access to a finite product. So I'm a huge history nut and have spent a tremendous amount of time researching history and looking at the period. I'm absolutely enthralled with the Revolutionary War period and our founding fathers and everything that came about to make our country strong. But I also recognize that the 21st century as a whole, the 20th century as a whole, is the bloodiest century in mankind's history. And every one of the major conflicts that we were involved in as a people really evolved around access to resources. Short of the Crusades, virtually every conflict was dedicated towards a nation's opportunity to secure a resource. And for the last century almost, it's been around fossil fuels. And when you recognize that no matter how much you want to believe that all of these newfound opportunities in shale and tar and all the rest of the garbage that's going on in our environment is going to preserve the opportunity, finite means finite. We need a bridge. And that bridge needs to be renewable if we expect the security of this nation to be protected. Because the prosperity of the world as we know it evolves around its consumption of energy. But when you have a finite source that is the principal provider, you have to figure out what to do. Where's the bridge? How do we get from point A to point B? So I began to focus much more of my efforts in looking at those. And in 1999, I was introduced to New Leaf, saw the opportunity here in San Diego, along with a number of other things, and created the first study, if you will, of looking at opportunities to be able to introduce that bridge technology into the Department of Defense's portfolio. And over the course of time, I'm proud to say that I actually believe that the efforts here in Southwest and pushing those efforts on a larger scale actually created the need for the Office of the Secretary of Navy to create an Office of Energy and Renewables in the Secretariat, and are now leading the way to doing new and great things with the technologies as they evolve. We have a master plan here in the Southwest that Major General Mike Leonard and myself put together in 2005 that will blow the minds of most individuals when it comes to renewables, changing the dynamics of the environment in which we live, very similar to the dynamics in which you face, are the real challenges, not the opportunities that are in front of us. So again, when given the opportunity, I really started focusing my attentions on how to break the dependency between foreign oil and our energy needs. What do we need to do, and how do we need to engage them differently? And again, over the course of the last 300 years, what most folks don't recognize is that while we've controlled our growth somewhat, the rest of the non-industrialized world is growing at a rate six times the pace that we grew from the industrial period to today. And the real difference is that they're not taking the same baby steps that got us to this point. They're moving from, in some cases, the 17th century immediately into the 21st century. And that six times pace is a conflict of resource that will be inevitable. So if we don't start, we don't extract our heads from that proverbial hole, we're going to be in tremendous conflict. Because eventually, no matter how much you forecast, it's going to run out. And this bridge, this new army of national security assets represents some of that bridge. And as I told Russ outside, we're at a point in our nation where no longer are the uniformed members of the service the only individuals to protect the nation's security. Every one of us have a part to play. A meteorologist and oceanographer by degree, I understand the dynamics and fluids, both of the atmosphere and the ocean. And whether you want to believe it or not, climate change is here. And whether it's caused by man or caused by some other form, it's here. The cap is melting at 20 times the rate. Mount Rainier, the last representative glacial space in the northern continent, has been exposed to the sun for the first time in 400 years for three consecutive years. We are at a precipice of potentially an environmental change that will impact the ability for our nation to be as prosperous as it has in the future. And as a grandfather, you see, I go to work every day now not talking about defending the opportunities for my children and my family to live in an environment that is afforded the rights of the Constitution. I now am looking forward to the protecting and preserving the opportunity of my grandchildren to live in a country that's prosperous, safe, and secure. And unfortunately, when I look forward, I'm not so sure that the course we're embarked upon today will make that possible. So it's time to turn around and look at ourselves in the mirror, and I'm glad to see that students are engaged. But the truth is that the model that our grandparents built for us secured for us the opportunities that today we enjoy. The sad part is that model is not sustainable. And when you want to talk about sustainable, that's really the issue. We cannot continue to consume in the fashion that we are. We need to look at where to apply our resources and how to embark on new efforts. So much has happened in the course of the last couple of years that make it really something that if you don't focus how it's happening and where it's happening, then you really lose sight of just how big of an issue we have to deal with. First and foremost, you see that from 1970 to 1990, the U.S. fuel consumption is pretty much stable. We only grew at about 3%. And those are relatively good terms because we are becoming much more conscious of our consumption, but in an overall fashion, still represents growth, and you have to expect that. But again, here's where you have to really understand the difference, and that is that Japan grew by 32%. China grew by 159%. In India grew by 175%. And those are the figures to 1990. From 1990 to today, China has grown by an additional 125%. India has grown at an additional 153%. So you can see the rapid acceleration of need for that resource that's occurring in those particular portions of the world that really were not part of our model. And we need to focus and get that taken care of. As a matter of fact, in China, production in China and use in China in 1975 were about a million barrels a day, and they consumed a million barrels a day. Today, they outstrip their production capacity by 30.5 million barrels a day. So, again, 30.5 million barrels a day is the same resource that the rest of the industrialized world is looking to procure for their security. We're at that point in time when the crossroads inevitable. And for we mariners, we plot on a chart a DR, and no one in their right mind in our business plots a dead reckoning trace that would take us through the shoals. But we are. We're plotting even worse. We're actually plotting a course that takes us in direct conflict with a big island. And we need to change the way we're doing. So Why did I then move from one to the other? I went to work at the University of San Diego as the Vice President for Business Services and Administration and embarked on an extremely aggressive program. As a matter of fact, within the first year, I installed 1.5 megawatts of solar, putting the University of San Diego on the map as the single largest producer of photovoltaic energy of any private university in the country. We created an effort where we saved more than 30 million gallons of water, and in the first year of energy conservation, saved the students and their tuition dollars $1.36 million in energy costs alone. Thanks. So it can be done. The issue is, and here's why I'm not at the university anymore, after the first year, every suggestion that I brought forward, I was told, Len, you're moving too fast. Slow down. We don't move this quick in the world of academia. I'm not a slowdown guy. I don't come to work every day to collect a paycheck, waiting for opportunity to happen. In my entire life, for 33 plus years, I created opportunity. So I sought outside of the university a different space to work in, and I found CCSE. I served on the board for a couple years in the California Center for Sustainable Energy. Our principal mission is to accelerate the transition to a sustainable world powered by renewable energies. But it also is very dedicated on making certain that California attains its AB 32 standards, really focusing its attentions on greenhouse gas emissions, renewable energy portfolio, and we are agnostic in our application. So from building performance to biodiesel energy, we work the space. We work hard every day to try to make some of those things happen, and we're very excited about where we're going. So we work with policymakers, legislators, you name it, consumers. Many folks who are in this room have done work with us. We're heavily engaged in fleet transformations, for example. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that really got us started. When I was the regional commander here, New Leaf presented us an opportunity, and between the time we started till the time we finished, we converted all non-tactical diesel in the region to a biodiesel product. So when Governor Schwarzenegger made the announcement, if you remember in a 2006 or 7 state address, he said that California was the leader in biodiesel use in the country. He's right, but we used 4/5 of that diesel product for the state of California. So it's exciting to see where it's come, because when I first started down this road, biodiesel production in the states was about 27 million gallons, and what was really difficult for us to get started was that I couldn't satisfy my demand when I made that requirement in the first years. I simply was outstripping the capacity to be able to provide those. But today, that's not the case. As a matter of fact, we're at $1 billion and potentially $1.7 billion. And the folks who are in this room are the warriors of that achievement. So I think you all deserve a round of applause for yourself. What a great place to go from 27 to 1.7. So we're heavily engaged, and as I said, one of the things that we do at CCSE is we're heavily engaged in the greenhouse gas emissions. So we have a very large, as a matter of fact, we administer the California State Rebate Program for plug-in electric vehicles. And we're responsible for a little over 30,000 vehicles, almost 50,000 now, on the roads in California. And it represents more than a third of the PEV sales in the country. So we're embarking on that effort and very, very proud of that. There are more than 100,000 now PEVs throughout the entire country. So as I said, the oil supply is finite. And where do we go and how do we get there from here? Biodiesel is the bridge, and it is one that we have to engage in. It's one that we have to be serious about, but it's also one that's challenged. And I was here in the presentation before, and one of the areas that was being talked about was the clash between agriculture, commerce, and a biodiesel feedstock. And it's real, and it needs to be addressed. But it is something that, if we don't engage, again, the opportunities will be lost. And I look at it as a point in time in which we need to begin to educate those who are capable of providing us with the proper legislation and regulation. We should not be fighting today with EPA on the issues surrounding the renewable standards. We should not be trying to convince them that biodiesel and the other products are one and the same, and that we should be limiting one or the other. We should be engaging, and those individuals should be smart enough and educated enough to basically create a regulatory process that allows the expansion of one technology over the other, if that be the case. But it represents, I think, one of the principal needs that I will address as the final, because there are three things that I think we all need to do if we're going to move forward. And it's really simple, because as the interns represent the future, so too does our responsibility in making sure that we lay the groundwork for them to be successful. And I will kind of wrap up my remarks with a really simple, everything in time is based on your opportunity. And I believe at this particular point in time, there are three things that this industry needs to dedicate its attention on. You ready? Education, education, education. It is that simple. It's important that we represent the new opportunities that technologies provide for us. And it's time to stop having the stupid and deliberate discussions with those individuals who simply want to misrepresent the past for the preservation of their future. And I say this because it is the oil industry and the energy industry who are your enemies. And no matter how you look at it, the only way you're going to overcome it is through non-emotional education opportunities, representing in truism how they get from where they are to where they, how they get from, how they got from where they were to where they are today. And I say, go ahead. And I say this in sincerity, because take a look at, in 2009, how much money was spent in subsidies to fuel, to the oil fuel industry. Any idea? Well, they say they're not subsidized, right? At least their subsidies are fair and equal for their challenges. $683 billion. And those are misrepresented for all practical purposes for we who are mathematicians and the likes, because they will argue that the money spent in subsidy for the new growth, let's get to the next one. How much money was spent in subsidizing renewables, of which biodiesel is one? Pales in comparison, folks. $38 billion. But yet we're on a fair and equal playing ground, are we not? I don't think so. Not one of the major hydroelectric plants in this country was built without taxpayer support, and if not in total, your tax dollar? How much did it cost to build the Hoover Dam? Any ideas? $5 million. And the contractors, the six contractors, had to put $1 million together to secure the bond, because there was not a single construction company in the country who had $1 million that they could put up. Today, the energy industry will tell you that the equalized number in subsidy equates to $683 million. You couldn't build the Hoover Dam today for under $7 billion. So if we really want to be fair in what those opportunities represented, then we need to educate people so that they understand the difference. How much of the conversation has occurred around the PUC creation? Regulators, federal regulators that virtually afford every energy company by regulation the opportunity to secure 10% on its investment. Okay, business owners, how many of you are afforded that same luxury and opportunity in regulation? Not a one of you. But the Power and Utilities Commissions are set up to ensure that those agreements are considered in the structure that represents those energy industries. It's exactly the same in the petroleum industry. It doesn't make any difference. The models of yesterday are not sustainable into the future, and it's time to start focusing our attentions on educating so that those balances are tipped. And if we don't do it for just technology alone, we ought to be doing it for our national security. The second is we need to push for regulatory certainty. We need to educate so that regulatory certainty is part and parcel to your business plan. The industry itself cannot be subjected to changing whims and ways of whatever it is that we're going to do. Imagine if the fuel industry were in the same fashion, if the oil industry were in the same fashion. I mean, they're regulated for different means, but they're never limited by the federal government or regulators on the amount of production that they're allowed to provide. But you all are. How is that possible? We need to push for regulatory consistency. We need to clear up misconceptions. And I made a statement the other day about the Navy's biodiesel fleet. And it's not that it's a misperception. I understand the difference between the two. But the truth is they're bridging technologies. And the misperception is that one is the same. The fact that the Navy's embarking on the process, to me, is very exciting. The realization will come that the current delivery process is insufficient to meet the demands. So you better recognize that there's an alternative that's growing and potentially has the opportunity to equal or surpass the others. And if you stifle one in conjunction with the other, you're stifling both. And if the potential rests with one to exceed or supersede the other, then we ought to be embarking in the same fashion that we did in 1911 between AC and DC. I see it as no different. And now we're even having conversations whether or not we should go back to DC. And maybe we should. So I think industry needs to work towards a long-term competitive and conventional strategy that helps to educate, inform, and produce opportunities. And of course, the NBB is an advocate for all of those efforts. I applaud you for your efforts through the week. I'm sorry I wasn't here yesterday, as I said, Joe, for your State of the Union address to the group. But I'm hearing that lots of good things are happening, exciting things are happening, and I think that you lay the groundwork for this education platform to start. I would seriously recommend that each of you start your campaign and create an opportunity for a much more deliberate conversation so that everybody's really recognizing. We still, CCSE is heavily engaged in the Clean Cities Coalition. And we are heavily engaged in trying to support, defend, and move forward the adoption of biodiesel as a solution for fleets. Truth is that we have to pull people to that conversation. But the more and more people adopt, the more people start to see what those opportunities are. And I can tell you that having gone down that route, it was extremely difficult for me to convince Naval Facilities Engineering Command to convert our waterborne craft to a biodiesel product. But I can tell you that it is the place where we need to go. And we do need to work in order to make those kind of things happen. And we are in the position that allows us to be able to take advantage of this bridging technology and push the agenda such that it becomes part of the mainstream and not just something that we know about. Everyone needs to know about it. So again, congratulations, and accept the title, Warrior of the Bridge. But you do represent the opportunity that I work for every day. And again, it's not about me, because I'm absolutely certain that the security that we currently live in is assured for at least the rest of my lifetime. My grandchildren, I'm not so sure. My job here on planet Earth is to make sure that my grandchildren are protected and provided the same opportunities and prosperity that I was afforded by mine. So be part of that challenge. Represent, as a matter of fact, I'm in the process of writing a book. I will call it Save the Planet. What a joke. God has different plans. It was here long before we got here. It'll be here long after we've destroyed it if we don't change our course. So be part of that effort. As an individual who wrote many, many, many conservation plans, having been responsible for more than two-thirds of the endangered species, flora, and fauna in this country, if I had to write a plan for this particular environment, it would be very simple, because EPA has two principal guidelines: identify the ecosystem in which you expect to protect, identify the invasive species that threatens that ecosystem. The ecosystem's Earth. The invasive species is man. The only difference between it and the hundreds of plans that I was responsible for writing, it is the only plan in which the species that is, in fact, the endangering species has the fortitude, the aptitude, and the capacity to coexist in that environment we're trying to protect. And we need to change the model so that that's possible. Thanks.
Spectacular, as always. That was really good.
So, the Admiral is going to stay to answer a couple of questions. So,
don't be shy.
Hi. Can you say a little bit more about the conversion process in terms of how you had to get the attention of the people involved to make them convinced that this was the right way to go? I'm sure it must have been very, very difficult.
It was extremely difficult. But again, I think one of the things that helped us in particular is, and it's a little bit different from the outside environment, I not only own it, I operate it and pay for it. So in some cases, the evolution of convincing individuals were found in our opportunities to just do things a little bit differently and convinced. You know, in California in 1999, if you remember, in 2000, we deregulated here in California energy. I had embarked on a sustainability project in 1999 when I became the commanding officer, working with SDG&E to start to convert, save, and change out my HVACs. I went through the entire portfolio of how can I do this differently. When that energy conservation fund that I had created ended up paying the $18.2 million increase that I suffered as a result of that deregulation effort, people in Washington recognized that, hey, they're doing something different, because every other region and facility across the country had to go back to the Congress and ask for an appropriation adjustment. I didn't. So it was at that point in time in which, and I had a couple great mentors. As a matter of fact, Admiral Ronnie Froman, Jose Benacourt, Admiral Chris Weaver, who was then the Commander Installations Command, Admiral Cole, who too, and even some of my CEC friends, for example. I mean, I learned more in my 4 years as a base commanding officer in CEC than I ever want to know about. But it was really these individuals started to see, because we were all then responsible for that budget, and that budget difference had a huge impact on the operations of the fleet. And different from the rest of the world, I think that no matter what I did in the Navy, my focus was always that everything that I did every day was focused on making absolutely certain that I did not impact the operations of the fleet. So in making those changes and creating those opportunities for savings in the infrastructure support, it launched us into a whole new revolution of sustainable. And fortunately enough, as I said, I was able to create through pressure the emphasis that secured the money to basically build in 2001 the Port Hueneme Sustainability Center. Because we needed someplace where engineers could look at the technologies, deploy them in pilot projects, and then launch them out into the Navy for a successful opportunity. So today, 150 some odd engineers, I think, are actually employed in that organization. And we're focusing our attentions, not today, which is really, again, really the cool part, is that we're actually seeing that they can translate into the operational force. And our necessity, again, from that perspective, has launched the Secretariat into an entire different look at how we do business. Three out of five casualties in Afghanistan are the result of moving PO&L to our forward operating base, petroleum, oil, and logistics. So three out of five casualties are the result of us having to move logistics into a forward operating base in Afghanistan. If we can make a more renewable and a more sustainable force, that's the Achilles heel of our conflict in the future. We have to figure out how to get there from here.
Admiral, amazing speech and story, and thank you again. Thanks. Very much for coming. So myself, as a young guy, I'm often put in a position where, you know, as you mentioned, we're dealing with a minefield of information out there, and I really only have time for what you could call an elevator pitch to try and correct people's opinions, views, and, you know, not a whole lot of patience necessarily without the illustrious career. Is there any advice that you could give me in really getting through to people who may have been misinformed in a quick and effective way?
You know, that's a great question, because it is a tough thing for us to do, and I think that in some cases, as a matter of fact, USDA was here, and I was talking to him out in the corridor. But in some cases, it's a realization of exactly how poorly we're structured so that the intersection of information gets to the right people. And again, I'm a historian and, you know, a graduate of the Naval War College, and understand the strategies associated with policy and decision-making. But the structure worked very well through the 18s and early 1900s. The Secretariat structure and our departments, as we have them structured today, are very dysfunctional. And, you know, I would tell you that the government, as it's acting today in the fashion that it is very pre-Goldwater Department of Defense. Each of them doing their own business. Nobody cares what the intersection looks like. And the Republic needs to take a look at what that really represents. How do you get there from here? I would say that education of the lawmakers, recognizing that regulators play a big part in what you're doing, but I would also think that informing the citizenry and engaging in education, literally, from the lowest level to the senior-most level, schools like UCSD and Point Loma Nazarene and USD are creating programs where students are now challenged into the idea of looking at the model. And that's where the transformation needs to occur. But it's our responsibility to make sure that your efforts are not met with the roadblocks that were created by the models that, you know, and I always say, if you went to Harvard Business School, and I'm a graduate of Harvard Senior Management, but they have their model, and they teach their model. And everybody who's out in the world right now only believes that that model works. I was a warfighter. I'm a student of Sun Tzu, and the biggest threat to a warfighter is consistency in application and practice. You got to adapt. You have to be willing to adapt. You've got to be willing to educate those who can inform. And honestly, that's the challenge. How many of you saw the 60-minute piece that was on just a few weeks ago? Yeah. So, you know, when I sat there and listened to it, I thought, my God, why is there no one in the industry who is speaking out against what this is portrayed? Why is it that we can't find somebody? Why is it that the champions are not coming to the table to recognize that there's a tie between that particular type of PR, because that's what it is, it's not reporting, it's PR, and reality? And if they're not tied, and I'll go back because this is an issue that I've addressed a number of times in my speeches. You know, the first time a president made a speech on our dependency of foreign oil and the necessity from a national security perspective to address that problem, do you know when that was? Lyndon Johnson. And every president from that point forward has said the same stupid thing. I can say that now because I'm not in uniform. But this country has no energy policy. And if you want to create the mechanism by which a nation evolves, then you have to have a cogent policy based on some strategic requirement. And that strategic requirement has not been defined, not by grassroots, not by industry, not by the Congress. We continue to amend. I really thought that, and again, not a great fan of current ongoings, but I really thought that there was an opportunity for national security policy to be created under this administration. I was abysmally disappointed by what came out of what potentially could have been the first effort to radically reform the energy policy of this country. And all we did was we put a few more numbers on it and we pushed the date out another 15 years. That's not an energy policy. For studies of history, when JFK made his speech that we were going to the moon, JFK had no intention of going to the moon. That was not the purpose. As a matter of fact, if you read Kennedy's papers, there's a significant amount of dialogue between the senior individuals within the government and Kennedy as to whether or not it was a bridge too far and whether or not he would be viewed as a fool because the scientists of the day did not believe that potentially that was possible. But what Kennedy needed to do was rally the country in an effort that had nothing to do with the space race. It had everything to do with the dominance of opportunity that was created as a result of the Second World War and the Cold War that then evolved. It had everything to do with that. And miracles, and I still believe that those miracles exist in this country, shortly thereafter, we're not only orbiting, but we're landing. It was an issue of self-preservation and national security. That same emphasis from the American population is not understood today, and that's what we need to do. We need to dedicate this effort in bridging the technologies, creating the mechanisms by which our security is secured through the advancement of technology. And I'm tired of hearing it, and I don't want to go too long here, but you know, Hitler put the most powerful mechanized army to work in 1939, never having access to petroleum. How did he do that? Well, in 1937, two scientists, Fischer and Tropes, created a mechanism by which the refining of coal produced diesel. Pretty neat. The plan then created the opportunity for Hitler to advance into the petroleum-producing countries of the world, hence led to the invasion of, again, history. The truth is, and here's where the real emphasis lies, is that I'm tired of being told over and over and over again by the communities that, you know, we've already tried that, and it's just not possible. Bull. We're dealing with the three largest molecules in the periodic table. And we are at the precipice, no joke, of manipulating the strands of DNA that separate humankind from the primate. And you're telling me we can't figure out how to manipulate the three largest molecules in the periodic table? I think what the problem is we've not dedicated our efforts. There's where the education lies. The necessity, the requirement, the understanding of every American citizen in what this means. Another speech.